Welcome. You're listening to the Internet Advisor Podcast with your co-hosts, Gary Baker, Foster Brown, and their team of experts. Since 1998, this program has been helping people like you with your computer problems, introducing you to valuable resources and programs, and promoting tech businesses in our area. The Internet Advisor is a two-hour radio program heard weekly on WJR 760 AM in Detroit and across the state on the Michigan Talk Network. Now, here are your hosts with this week's Internet Advisor.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at InternetAdvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Welcome aboard. Hi, this is Foster Brown, and we've got a great show. I say that every week. I believe it. This week, we're going to be looking into the rather shocking announcement of 1.2 billion passwords being stolen by a Russian gang, allegedly. Well, we're going to have Richard Steenan, our international expert in security, in studio with us, along with Nicole Johnson, who has been doing cybersecurity for Cisco for a long time. You got to stick around. There are some really fascinating things coming up on our show today, as well as an hour of helping you. Well, we're back to the gang of three. Kind of the original gang here. We have with us in studio Mr. Gary Baker. Good to have you here, Gary.
It's great to be here. It's a wonderful day.
And also, wonderful day in the neighborhood, also Mr. Ed Rudell. Hi, Dundee.
Hello, Foster. I'd rather be here than working on that muffler. It seems like every week I always have another project.
Although I have to say, after he picked me up when we were heading out of Royal Oak, we passed a garage sale and I thought for sure he was going to go off the road. He is a garage sailor. Well, folks, I have to say, first of all, for those of you who may have tuned in, and we're looking forward to hearing Cindy Paskey on with us, who is the founder of Strategic Staffing Solutions and a remarkable lady. She unfortunately was felled by a bug, and it really took her out of action, so she was not able to be with us today, but we'll be having her on in the near future. We do, however, and I'm delighted to say, have Nicole Johnson with us, and we'll be talking with her a little bit later on some more about security. And right now, guys, I want to catch up a little bit with what's been going on this week. I was on vacation. I'll tell you a little bit about that, but anything come up in news headlines that caught your eye before we get Mike Brennan in here to get his headlines?
No, just those, what we're going to talk about, the 1.2 billion. And I was reading through those articles, and I just found it hard to believe that there were that many people spread out through that many different websites.
You're so, talking about the story that came out earlier this week
user
about
IDs 1.2 and passwords.
Billion passwords, usernames that were stolen by, allegedly by, a Russian gang. Yeah. You know, allegedly by a Russian gang. And Richard's going to talk to that coming up.
It's almost great to be part of, if you're going to get, you know, if somebody's going to get your username and password, it's great that you're one of 1.2 billion. The chances of them using my credit card are probably a lot smaller than if they had taken six.
Well, that's true, but the credit card information was not stolen. It was user IDs and passwords.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Which then might give them opportunities to get other information.
Right.
But
and
who
knows,
right? Because we don't know the list of websites.
Exactly.
And they're
not going to release it because they have non-disclosures with so many of the corporations that provided the server information.
Right.
So they're not going to disclose. And they've had it since April.
But this, we're talking about Hold Security, the company that released that information. And I'm sure we'll talk about this in detail with Richard
Steenan
coming up in just a minute.
He will have a very informed opinion.
I had to tell you guys that one of the things that happened to me was this last week. We were delighted to be able to go up to my daughter's cabin, which is just outside of Gladwin. But the problem is there's no connectivity there at all. No phone. The AT&T signal, if you go to a certain stump at the riverside, you can get a little bit of it, but not enough for your email. And we made a pilgrimage every day into Gladwin to a coffee shop.
That
there
is a serious case of nomophobia.
Oh, nomophobia. No kidding. And by the way,
for people out there, nomophobia is the fear of having no mobile. And it's actually, I mean, it is.
It's real.
It's real. I can't believe they came up with that. Anyway.
What am I going to do with my hands? You know, you know, really, you can't get updates on
Well, I was loving
social medias.
I was loving reading. I had a great time. Yeah. Unfortunately, the book I had was on my laptop on the Kindle.
Oh.
But it was there on my machine, so I was able to read through the book. I finished it, however,
until
so I could load
died.
A new one on. There are a lot of other ones in the
You didn't go swimming
account.
With that this year, did
no,
you?
No, no.
Okay. All right.
Jerry
is
referring
just
to a tragic
testing.
Event a couple years ago when I jumped in the river there, not remembering that I had my iPhone in my pocket. And it got very wet. No, no. Fortunately, okay. That didn't happen this okay. year. But one of the things that struck me is, you know, we talk about, I think in some ways we kind of chastise ourselves on not being able to live without being connected. But there really is so much useful things that aren't connected to and want to stay connected to, mm-hmm. whether it's the news of what's going on in the world mm-hmm. or whatever it may be.
Well, and, you know, if you hadn't stayed connected, you would have missed the fact that there's a new Nigerian email swindle. Right, I thought, what do you mean a new one? I mean, there's been so many. Why is one more?
Got to be a retread, you know?
Yeah, why is one more news? But anyway, I hope people have figured out that those are swindles and they shouldn't fall prey to them.
Well, it's time for us to say hello to Mr. Mike Brennan, who is the editor of MI Tech News. Mike, welcome to the show.
So it's actually the Gang of Two and Captain Nomophobia.
There we go, yes. And one of your reporters is in studio with us, too. That's Nicole Johnson. And as a matter of fact, Nicole, you can go ahead and press the button and say hello to the boss is on the line here.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
How you doing, Nicole?
Mike is going to be in here helping us with security matters in just a little bit. But Mike is the editor of MI Tech News, and as a matter of fact, Nicole is one of the reporters and handles things about STEM education and women's
science,
issues.
Science, technology, engineering, and math.
Right, STEM. And women in technology as well. So we'll be talking with her a little bit about that later on. Mike, let's talk about some of the headlines in this week's MI Tech News. And then we could tell people about how to get hold of that. One of the things I saw here was the Michigan facing a critical shortage of tooling professionals to fill the skills gap.
Yeah, I was up in Traverse City at the Center for Automotive Research's big hoedown they have there every August. And a lot of really interesting information. And I did an interview with Lori Harbor from the Harbor Reports. Her dad started that, and she's taken over.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things that she talked about, if you think back, the main reason that auto industry really started in Michigan was there was tool and die shops everywhere.
Yep.
Well, there still are to a degree, but the problem is that most of those very skilled folks are 56 years old or older, getting ready to retire, and there really isn't a core group behind them to step in. And so there's a big initiative underway now to recruit more people, to train more people, to get them plugged in. Otherwise, it could be really bad for the auto industry.
Well, Mike, we've only got time for one headline today. We'll maybe mention some more later on. But folks, if you'd like to get hold of a copy of MI Tech News, it's free. All you got to do is go to internetadvisor.net, scroll down on our page, and click the subscribe button. I'll tell you a little bit more about the MI Tech News after the break. Well, in this edition of the Internet Advisor, we're going to be focusing on the whole world of cyber warfare, cybersecurity, and Richard Steenan, who is our global expert on that, will be with us in just a moment. We also have somebody else in the studio who is going to be helping us with that as well, and that's Nicole Johnson, who is very much involved in emerging technology and is, as a matter of fact, one of the young leaders in that area in our Detroit area. And has been, as a matter of fact, also teaching security at Davenport University and Lansing Community College. We'll be getting to her in just a minute. I do want to wrap up one thing with Mike Brennan before we leave. Mike, we got you on a little late in that first break, and so I wanted to wrap up talking about maybe two more of the headlines from MI Tech News. One of them will tie in perfectly to our conversation about security and this supposed breach of 1.2 billion passwords being stolen. One thing I wanted to talk about is something that you focus on, which is on Michigan businesses expanding both within Michigan and around the country. And New Horizons, according to you there, New Horizons Great Lakes, has bought up 11 new franchises in the Northeast and expanding out there.
Yeah, it's made them actually the largest New Horizon worldwide training network in the country now. So with what they already have and with the 11 new ones that they're adding in such big centers as New York, Boston, Philly, Hartford, those places, they're the biggest in the country right now.
Right. And they do a lot of training for people who are, you know, current employees, getting them up to speed on stuff. They had a great program when we talked with them on the air, working with veterans, for instance, and helping them get up to speed in technology. And the final thing here, by the way, folks, these are headlines from MI Tech News, and you can find them at mitechnews.com. But even better, you can get them delivered to your door every Friday absolutely free by going to internetadvisor.net, going down the page to Mike's smiling face, and right next to there is a button that says subscribe here. Click that button, and you put in your email address, and no dollars and cents, and you're going to get these headlines and many more. So, Mike, let's wrap up on the last one here that I saw, which is that there are 5 unanswered questions about the billion passwords that were stolen allegedly by the Russian hackers.
Yeah, I'd like to claim credit for this, but this is actually some good analysis from PC World. But as you read them, where do the credentials come from? What websites? What are the hackers going to do with them? What sort of, the passwords hashed, or were they plain text and all that jazz? It begins, since then I've read other stuff, and I know Richard also has this opinion that maybe this isn't such a big deal. It sounds like a large number, but how big of a threat is it? It's hard to assess right now.
Exactly, and that's, matter of fact, precisely what we're going to talk about with him right now. So, Mike, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for MI Tech News. Folks, don't forget, you can subscribe absolutely free at our homepage. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome, Foster.
All right. Hey, and on that note, let's introduce our primary guest for this afternoon, and that is Mr. Richard Steen. How you doing, Richard?
Hey, Foster. Good to be with you again.
Delighted to have you with us. We've talked with Richard on occasion, Gary, in some pretty august circumstances.
That's certainly true. And Richard just came back from Black Hat 2014.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about Black Hat, some of the things going on there. Can we touch on this first thing? I think something that caught all our eyes and ears. And let me introduce Nicole Johnson to the conversation as well. I believe the two of you have met before. Nicole Johnson is with us, and she's also somebody who is working with cybersecurity. You work with Cisco, right, Nicole?
Yeah, that's right. Nice to be on with you, Richard.
Hi, Nicole. Great to be on with you.
Yeah. Now, let's tackle this first thing. We've all seen this headline. 1.2 billion passwords have been stolen by a Russian hacker gang. Let's just deal with that first of all. Are those numbers true? What is this? Is this really the case?
Well, it actually ties into Black Hat. You have to be very suspicious of all headline gathering announcements right before Black Hat. Everybody tries to one up everybody else.
Yeah.
And apparently a researcher in Wisconsin who's got not necessarily a pristine history. Mm-hmm. Made that announcement, immediately rolled it back to only 600,000 IDs. And then some journalists in Milwaukee kind of dug into some other statements he's made and et cetera. So it's like there's actually no proof. So far, all of this news is just about one researcher saying he's found this, but he hasn't provided any evidence that this has happened. So you have to question that.
Well, I thought it was a security firm called Holden.
Hold Security.
Holden
is the main name of the man who was in charge of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So one guy, little company, just like Steen and Associates, if I had it, has made these claims. And,
it was really suspicious.
Even if it's true, at this point, it should be no big deal, right? You shouldn't have passwords that are reversible via, the hash analysis that people do. It should be complicated. It should be different for every website. So even if somebody stole your password for internetadvisor.com, they wouldn't get your bank access. So,
Richard, that you bring up a great point about passwords, and that is, when you hear all the security experts like you, because you're a true expert in this field, and you tell somebody like me or somebody else that might be listening, it has to be very complex. Don't ever write it down. It has to be different for every site. Is that realistic? I mean, I can't remember.
You should write them down.
Okay. Thank you.
Exactly, because a Russian hacker isn't going to be able to read my sticky note that I have next to my desk with my 100 IDs and passwords.
And the chances are that that's a whole lot safer in your house or in your desk drawer, except in where I work. We're not allowed to do that, but anywhere else.
I won't even use a password manager because a couple of them have proven to be vulnerable.
Really?
They're also, if somebody were to actually get onto my PC, wouldn't they look for RoboForm or Password One or one of the other password managers out there?
Yeah, and supposedly those are encrypted, but how good is the encryption, et cetera? And that's what's happened recently is it turns out it's not great because it hasn't been vetted by, you know, an open source community. Yeah.
So, all right, let's back up.
Okay.
First of all, had there really been 1.2 billion passwords
stolen?
Well,
we don't know.
Is that the status that we don't know? Yeah. Because I understand that they went back on it already.
I thought he just said that.
He said they went back, and they said 600 million, and then even that one is...
Okay. So, I mean, immediately, with duplicates and everything else, they've already... They already brought it back to lower
it's
than
not
that.
Even that.
Okay. Okay.
And if you... I guess... To chime in, if you take a look at this news release, right, compared to something like Heartbleed, which is an attack we heard about months ago, Heartbleed had a very good diagnosis. Go to these sites. We know they were compromised. They have more information about the vector that was attacked. And I think in this case, you're getting a lot of really general information put in with something that has to do with the Russians. And they're not new to the security game.
Right.
And I think if you look at the state of the world, you can see that stories like this kind of take you down a route of mystery.
Well, it's also, and I think, Richard, you said this, because of Black Hat conference going on. It's kind of sensationalism, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And Black Hat covered so much more interesting things and scarier vulnerabilities. Those are new, those are the ones that I pay attention to.
Well, we're going to be talking about those. What I wanted to do was to kind of clear this first part up, and we began to touch on it, so let's just sort through this as well, and maybe Nicole, feel free to... So what is... Because I started using a password manager. I use LastPass, because I wanted to be as secure as possible, and it seemed that was the securest way to do it. Is that Richard anymore? What is secure anymore?
Yeah, what do you do, Richard? I handwrite mine on a little book.
Yeah, I memorize all of mine, but, you know, I can do that. I've been doing passwords forever. And for really complicated things, you know, like your access to your Amazon Web Services, then I write them down.
Okay. So you don't use, like, a central the idea of a central password manager was supposed to be that you could get a really complicated word that was to the vault, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then inside the vault, you could use the LastPass. You can generate some really pretty hairy, you know, 16, 24-character passwords if you want. And you didn't have to remember them because the software remembered them. But that's inherently also insecure.
Well, I don't know if it's insecure,
LastPass just announced that they fixed a serious vulnerability in their solution. So I don't know if you had to change your password or not.
It's also a target, right? If somebody gets on your computer, they may go toward any kind of password vault.
Yep.
When we come back, what I want to do, Richard Steenan is with us, and Nicole Johnson in studio, our guy's here too, is to talk a little bit more about an article that you mentioned about some possibilities of some real serious threats from the Russians. In a week where I happen to be on vacation, the world was kind of turned upside down by the announcement earlier in the week that 1.2 billion passwords were stolen by Russian hackers. And we've been talking about how that's been debunked to a great extent. Richard Steenan is with us. He's our favorite expert to talk about all things security. Also with us in studio is Nicole Johnson, who is a cybersecurity expert with Cisco. And Gary Baker and Ed Brudel are in studio as well. Richard, you have an article that we linked to on our homepage. It's entitled, Is Russia Poised to Retaliate Against Sanctions with Cyber Attacks? And from my perusal of this, it seems like you're saying that there is a very real Russian threat out there and a very organized one. So would you talk about that and what that retaliation might be?
Yeah, it's well known in the research community that the Russians are the very, very best at hacking, right? They're the ones that create these botnets that attack banks and steal credit card information and all the rest. But for years and years, they have really contained themselves to just attacking, you know, things that will pay them back. You know, so they've been making a lot of money all this time, extremely well organized. And then historically, there's some connection to the KGB and that the founders of this Russian business networks were all former KGB agents.
Now, hang on a second. The Russian business network, tell me about that, because I saw that and I thought, well, it's like the Chamber of Commerce, right?
Yeah. Well, these guys created some of the first marketplaces for malware. So they create new vulnerabilities and exploits and then sell them or even kind of have a managed service where you would use them, they take care of collecting the money and distributing
Wow. They commercialized hacking in that sense.
Yeah. And then they went silent. You know, they stopped branding themselves as the RBN. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, the hacking never went away. So we've had cybercrime growing into probably a multi-billion-dollar industry. And there's always been this question, is, well, how come they don't engage in, you know, the Russia versus the West kind of stuff that you see sniping going on the Internet?
Yeah.
And in talking to two separate researchers, they told me that they're picking up on chatter that they've been reined in specifically by the Kremlin, who's barred them, told them, you know, it's okay to do all this hacking for money, but don't get involved in hacking for political reasons like Anonymous and the rest of those hackers.
Okay.
So it was just the week before last that they started to hear that if sanctions reach a certain threshold, we don't know what that is, Russia could retaliate by unleashing the hacker swarm on the West. And my suspicion is that because they're so good at banking hacking that it would be against the financial system.
Wow. So two things strike me about that. First of all, I guess I've always painted China as the big cyber bully. I mean, or I should say the bushwhacker that's out there, you know, kind of doing the terror kind of things. But you're saying that in reality, it's been the Russians all along who were the real sharpshooters.
Yeah, they're the ones that get, you know, these guys that deal with cyber attacks every day. Actually, when they talk about them, they are fearful because of the level of sophistication and ability to do harm if they so choose.
If they ever unleash that kind of... Nicole, are you with Cisco, are you hearing this in terms of the corporate levels that you're working with?
Definitely. I don't think these Russian hackers are trying to get to my personal Facebook, right? Not a lot of valuable monetary things there, but definitely from the corporate side, we're not facing hackers that are in their dorm room. I mean, this is a organized, often government involvement type thing. I mean, these are professionals, so you have to defend in new ways because they're always morphing and evolving the types of attacks.
So what I'm hearing you saying, Richard, is that the Russians are saying, look, if you put any more pressure on us about Lithuania or things that are going on there, that we're liable to let these guys go and just have at it with your business. Could we see them going after the infrastructure as well?
If you think about so far they're taking sanctions, you know, they're retaliating in a tit for tat, mm-hmm. and they've barred imports of Western food into Russia, which sounds more like shooting yourself in the foot than anything else.
Yeah.
But when the geopolitical situation gets to the point where it's an acceptable loss of faith and methodologies and tools and vulnerabilities, to cause havoc in banking systems. The banks are, you know, applying the sanctions that restrict the money movement of some of these oligarchs.
How prepared are you? You deal with corporations around the globe. How prepared are the banks to deal with that kind of heavy artillery being aimed at them?
It varies by bank. Some are extremely well prepared. Some are not prepared at all. It'll just devastate them.
Wow. Could this be the infrastructure, too, like electricity and water and gas? And I mean, could we see them coming, you know, at mainline America, you know, onto our shores, if you will, and going after those basics as well?
I think that would be an escalation. I think, this is a lot like warfare in that responses have to be proportional and like. So financial sanctions turn into financial attacks. If we started shutting off, you know, power and utilities to Russia, which, you know, they have all the power they need, then you'd see that sort of proportional response.
You know, there's been a lot said about the Internet of Things, right?
Mm.
And the ability for me to use my smartphone to turn on and off my lights, turn up or down my thermostat.
Right.
Are they subject to bugs and viruses and hacking?
Yeah,
What would they want? Why would somebody want to?
I don't know if Russian hackers would attack those because that would be a lot of, you know, small attacks against people's homes and your even at Black Hat they're demonstrating how easy it is to turn a Nest thermostats or smoke mm-hmm. alarm into spyware, essentially, grabbing your information.
My thermostat is spying on me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one thing, I talk a lot about the Internet of Things to corporations, and one thing is for sure, the Internet of Things connects more things. It brings things to life and brings them into the connectivity that we didn't have before. And with that comes risk, because you have an increased attack surface, and that's what you've got to look at. So with so many more mobile devices and so many more sensors being able to talk and connect, that gives more access to them for attacks and
I spent the week in Amish country, Richard.
I'm thinking of, safe place to be.
I'm thinking of heading back there. I'm wondering, have you seen among your colleagues, after coming back from something like Black Hat, who say, you know, I think I'll disconnect a few more things?
As a matter of fact, a keynote was delivered by Dan Gere, kind of a, old guy of security. Mm-hmm. And he said he's reevaluating his dependencies, he called them, just because he might have to get along without them.
Wow. Now, this is in terms of things that are plugged in, or just things that are networked more than that?
Things that are plugged in, and your own reliance on email for communication, and voice over IP for phone, and your smartphone for location services. All these things you rely on today. What if you didn't have them tomorrow? Would you still be able to operate your business or your life?
I was just cleaning out my trunk a couple days ago, and I found this old Michigan map back there, and I'm like, why do I keep this in here? And because I have GPS on my smartphone, and I'm like, maybe I shouldn't have thrown that out.
I just did that.
Get some maps.
It's funny. I just did the same thing. We were about to take off for this vacation, and I was going through the car, kind of getting things ready for it, and I had a fistful of old maps that are in the usual beat-up kind of shape. I thought, why do I need that? I got Waze.
Yeah, exactly.
to navigate me around. Richard Steenen is with us, by the way. He was at Black Hat this past week, and also in studio with us, we have Nicole Johnson. Richard,
I was just going to ask, what was the biggest aha out there at Black Hat?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, so I have a different perspective than a lot of people, since I don't attend a lot of presentations, but I get a feel of what's showing on the show floor.
Mm-hmm.
And enterprises, or the solutions for enterprises, businesses, have, since RSA of this year, have been addressing this issue of reducing the mean time to respond to an attack.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all, technically the solutions are there to detect pretty sophisticated attacks. But the response could take, hours or days in some cases. And of course, VeriSign reports, the average response time is 270 days.
Oh, wow.
So there's several solutions I've seen that now, once you've detected the attack, it's pretty much push button to, inform the firewall to shut off the command and control access and quarantine the machine that's infected and schedule it for being re-imaged and do all that with existing change control procedures automated as well.
Wow.
And that's really,
the
reason not being able to detect is really the reason it's taking so long, right? That they don't even know they're infected a lot of times.
Richard, we're going to come back in just a second. I want to hear some more of your insights from Black Hat. Tell people a little bit more about what Black Hat is. And then I want to wrap things up, guys, around the table here, talking about how do we practically make ourselves more secure in this highly insecure world. Back in just a moment with Richard Steenen here on the Internet Advisor. I want to take a moment to thank Annie Nichols, our Lady of the Phones, for being with us today. It's a rare appearance this summer. We're delighted to have her. And, of course, Rich Lozinski behind the board as our engineer. Thank you to both of you for making the program work so well. By the way, next hour, we're going to be talking about your questions. And that will be at our phone number, 800-859-0957. Right now, we're continuing our conversation. We've had focusing our whole show on Internet security and from the big picture of global. And that's with Richard Steenen, who's with us right now, and also with Nicole Johnson, who's in studio. Nicole, thank you, by the way, for joining us here in studio. She is a cybersecurity expert with Cisco. And
also with Mike Brennan from MyTech News.
Yes, pardon me. Yes, and also
as a contributing reporter there.
Yep, exactly, with the Michigan Technology News and MyTech News. Richard, let's go back to you. First of all, tell people kind of quickly, thumbnail, what is Black Hat? We've referred to it, and I figured, I'm sorry, presuming everybody knows, but what is Black Hat?
Yeah, back in the day, it was a conference started by Jeff Moss, who wanted to bring together, security researchers, hackers, black and gray and white hats, just to discuss vulnerabilities and methodologies and all that. But it grew over the years, and then it was acquired by United Business Media, and it's grown into a, you know, an industrial kind of conference mm-hmm. with a lot of vendors, 130 in the Expo Center.
Wow.
But still has the flavor of, you know, showing off new tricks and techniques for hacking.
Yeah, it was kind of a unique combination. It wasn't a gathering of the good guys, the bad guys, and those who were still undecided.
Yeah, so it's also married to a conference, even though no relation, that happens, is occurring right now. It's on the weekend, costs much less, called DEF CON.
Oh, DEF CON, yes,
and
I heard that.
That still maintains the character of hackers, and it's really crazy, and I got out of town before that started.
Why? Why did you get out of town before?
Well, I'm definitely a white hat, right? I've never engaged in black hat hacking of any sort, and, you know, I'm just... It's not my scene, and it's crazy. You know, people dress up in costumes and whatever. It's not me.
So it's like Comic-Con.
Yeah, exactly. Comic-Con, same people show up for both.
I got you. Darth Vader shows up a number of times at those things, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I want you to talk about something that I think is kind of interesting, and that is that there's a Twitter war going on in a place where there's a very real physical war going on.
Yeah, this is real time now, so just about, I don't know, 20 hours ago, soon after the president, you know, announced attacks against ISIS in Iraq, right?
Right.
So the, you know, kind of the next reincarnation of
Al-Qaeda?
Crazy terrorists doing horrible things. And now we're launching air attacks against them, and they started tweeting using a hashtag, and don't necessarily recommend you go view this because it's pretty drastically horrifying, but hashtag a message from ISIS to U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And there's hundreds of tweets from these terrorist accounts showing images of wounded and disfigured American soldiers, and they're basically saying, you know, we're coming for you now, U.S.
Yeah. Oh, my. Wow. And this is being, now, because Twitter can use images on it now, this it's kind of a psychological warfare. It's interesting how this has grown from the Arab Spring, where Twitter was used so effectively to organize opposition to an oppressive government, to now being used by the terrorists themselves as part of their propaganda war.
Yeah, or maybe the propagandists for the terrorists.
That's true.
You wouldn't think terrorists would be exposing themselves to the NSA by just tweeting nasty things.
Yeah, yeah. But, oh, yikes.
I've read a story where a fighter for the Russians was putting pictures on Instagram, and they were able to put together all the locations and bring big clues to what was going on there from the location of his posts.
Oh,
it's interesting.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating what can be done with this. Well, Richard, I want to thank you very much for having been with us and for sharing all that you did. Maybe one final thing. As you went through the Black Hat Conference, what do you see as one of the most critical issues or areas as you go forward with looking at security?
Yeah, so a researcher from IOActive, a research firm, demonstrated the vulnerability in satellite communication systems. So if you think about it, a lot of these things were designed over a decade ago when these attacks, you know, may not even have been possible.
Mm-hmm.
And because they use hard-coded passwords in these devices, you know, for maintenance and support,
sure,
just like a lot of stuff used to a decade ago, all those systems on ships and airplanes, military systems, the actual handheld devices they use for communicating are completely vulnerable to an attack.
Wow. So what practically could that have an impact on? That you could take over the control of an airplane and where it's going and spoof it, if you will?
You'd certainly take over the control of the communications to the airplane.
I gotcha.
So an air traffic controller kind of message to them, rerouting them.
Wow.
Or ships.
Ships as well.
Sure, similar things.
I was telling you during the break about a TV movie I saw called Delete, in which an artificial intelligence takes over and essentially goes to war against mankind. And what that thing did was to take over precisely those codes. So it was running oil tankers aground in critical areas. It was going after the command and control structure, you know, of our electronics and water and everything else. So it's fascinating to see that kind of very critical area. Boy, the next few years we're heading towards are, wow, I think I want to go back to the Amish and ask if I can move over on the buggy. I want to ride.
Take me with you. I'm ready.
Yeah. Richard Steenen, thank you so much for having been with us.
Thanks.
Take care. And folks, by the way, we've copied a lot of the things we were talking about and articles that Richard's written on our homepage at internetadvisor.net. Nicole, just maybe some final thoughts from you as somebody who talks about security with Cisco and with your clients. What do you see as some of the really most critical issues that you're facing?
Well, I think it's just bringing the information together. You know, we have a lot of data from all these different devices and sensors, and I think to the point is organizations that hold that precious data that they're after to have a good, solid security strategy that's continuous so that we can catch these attacks sooner.
Gary, I know that coming up this fall in September, there's going to be a big conference of IT specialists.
That's right.
Is that going to be focused on security?
Well, there's a number of conferences, but the one that specifically focus there, which is now in its third year. It's the North American International Cyber Summit, and this was started by Governor Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
It was sold out last year. They moved to Cobo Hall on on March 17th. I'm sorry, November 17th, coming up this fall. And there's some great speakers and great resources that are going to be there, but that's where the cyber security folks meet in Michigan.
We know from the governor that he is the cyber range that's out there.
That's right. He started a number of initiatives, and we need to be prepared.
Oh, yeah. The cyber range is a place where companies can go.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can go there
to
test out their systems, right?
They have an alternate reality where you can practice both defending and understanding attacks.
It's a great program. All right, last thing we want to do, go around the table here. I want to find out, what do you folks do individually for security? You know, do you have a little book you write things down in? Do you use a password manager? Nicole, let's start with you.
I just use handwritten, old school, you know, nothing digital, not even my bank records. I don't use the compilation. Really? I'll do online banking.
Do you create a complex password each time you go after it, or could it be a simple one?
Yeah, complex. And a tip is, if you have a sentence, Nicole went to the store, you would want to pick like the first letter of all that, and then you can use that for your password. So coming up with a phrase and using the first part.
Eddie, what do you use?
I create a contact in my contacts in my phone that synchronizes with Outlook and all my other devices, and then I put clues to what the password is, and then maybe the last two digits.
Okay.
Smart.
I have two password vaults that are empty. They're my. I'm just, if somebody gets on my system and they're going to go spend all their time dulling their pick on those trying to get
in. I love it. So where are they at? On sticky notes?
No, they're not on sticky notes. They are electronic, and
you're not going to let me know where they are.
I'm going to share that with you and 500,000.
I have to say, I use one of the password vaults, something called LastPass. We've been testing them out. Not perfect by any means. Richard just said, as a matter of fact, they were hacked. Hacked, but they were
fixed a vulnerability. Yeah.
RoboForm and Password One have been touted as some of the better ones.
Folks, coming up next hour, we're going to try to help you.
You're listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor. To see the show notes for this program, visit our homepage at www.internetadvisor.net. That's where you'll also find past podcasts, our toolkit full of free software to clean up your computer and keep it running strong, plus other resources. If you have a question for our hosts, just click the contact form on the homepage and send us an email with the details. Don't forget to look for us on Facebook. Now let's get back to the second hour of the Internet Advisor.
Welcome to hour number two of the Internet Advisor Show. That's when we get down to work helping you with your questions. You set the agenda by calling 800-859-0957. The only thing we have to say is the only dumb question is the one you don't ask. Please help us with your questions to help a whole lot of people. Again, that number is 800-859-0957. Annie Nichols is waiting to talk to you. It's always our delight to connect you with our team of technicians here. Mr. Gary Baker, who has been involved in information technology for decades now.
I'm not that old.
Ah, well, come on.
Yes, I am, but it's radio, so they can't tell.
I don't want you to ever say that again. Don't include decades, how long we've been on this
all
show.
All right. Yeah, we're moving towards 20 years, my goodness. In any case, Eddie Rudell is here as well. Ed has worked tirelessly in technology, a lot of experience.
End-user technology. You know, I think that's a good way of putting it, because I do desktop
like
support and basically end-user, what the person gets a hold of, and I'm the guy that has to try to figure it out to make it work for him.
Yep. And
what do you mean you bought a new mouse? What was wrong with the old mouse?
So if you want to get in touch with these folks, 800-859-0957 is the number to do that. And by the way, I might say at the beginning of the program here, this is the last of three programs in which you'll be able to dial directly to us and ask those questions. You can still do it through email by going to our homepage, internetadvisor.net, and clicking on the Contact Us button. During the week, we'll still get those emails with your questions. But right now, you have a unique opportunity to call 800-859-0957, and we will be able to tackle your problem right off the bat. So let's dive into this and talk with Victoria from Toledo, Ohio. And Victoria, I hope you have drinking water this weekend.
Oh, yes.
Thank heavens.
Yeah, lots of reasons to be phobic about things on that front, too.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we've been talking this last hour about all sorts of security problems. And
the water goes out in that area from the algae plumes over there and the toxins the algae release. You can't even filter the stuff.
I know,
you can't
even
boil it. It makes me very happy I have a 60-foot straw in my backyard.
It goes way down underground with all that filtering goes on. Well, let's talk to you about your concerns about phones.
Well, I wonder if I'm being too phobic or more than you, but I wonder, because I'm not as knowledgeable, of course. Well, one thing I just thought of, too, online banking. I don't do online.
Mm-hmm.
I'm comfortable with a computer for my job.
Sure.
But wouldn't that be more vulnerable to when the hacking occurs, like the Russian stuff?
I don't know myself. My thought is that the security of the banks, and it was said this last hour in many ways, the banks either are very good at this or are very poor. If they're very good at it because they know what's at risk, my thoughts are they probably have done a lot. I bank with Bank of America, for instance, and I'm pretty sure they got some really good security measures in there. But what are your thoughts, Ed? I know some people won't bank online, period. They don't care.
Right. I think you need to change your passwords frequently. I mean, how many times have you been issued a credit card from your bank for no reason, and you know that when you're issued a new card that there's been an infiltration? Mm-hmm. You know, because, I mean, I there's been a
good
couple
point.
Times
Just
where
happened
I
to recently.
Have, yep. There's been a time or two where I've had to call the bank and said there's been a transaction on there, or I've looked at the bill and saw a transaction. But there's also been times where nothing's happened for a year or two, and then I'm inside of 2 years, I'm issued two cards. Well, that means more than likely they've noted some type of security.
Or they suspected that something might have happened where you could have been hit.
And that's good. They're
absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, but then would that not have happened if you did not do online banking?
Well, I was just talking about the credit card. So online banking, a lot of people do that. I'm just suggesting you change your passwords frequently and you have good antivirus software on your computer. Definitely do not run a computer that's running Windows XP if you're going to be running online banking, because that's what, how long has Windows XP been, is no longer supported, although most antivirus providers said that they're going to continue providing antivirus for another 9 more months or so. But I would get off that system. It's insecure. If you're going to do any type of online banking. So make sure you have a good system.
So, Victoria, what system are you working with? What's your operating system on your computer? XP, Vista? Vista. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're, as Eddie said, XP is the most vulnerable. Gary, some thoughts on this?
I do online banking and have for a number of years. It's
so
really convenient. Yes, I'm concerned about it, like we all should be, right? And I'm speaking only for myself here at this point. But we all should be, concerned about it. So I make sure that I check regularly what my balance is. And if anybody has taken anything out of it, I will know right away. Banks primarily hold people harmless if that were to happen. But I think we're all moving in this direction, and it's going to continue to move in this direction. But we all have to be vigilant, in everything we do around anything that needs to have better security.
Your initial question...
And I have a very good password.
Yeah. Your initial question was about phones, though, right, Victoria?
Yeah, and I wonder, like, I know supposedly they're going to be ended in 5 or so years, but is it not the case that the wall phone allows you more privacy than the cordless phone?
Good question. Not just a cordless phone. You're talking about
a cell phone.
A cell phone. You mean like one where it's voice over internet? Like
yeah.
a Vonage or something
and,
like
and
that?
For example, yeah, and also like versus having the phone, the cheaper versions where
yes.
you get it through your router. You
what
know?
They call that? Plain old POTS. Plain yeah. old telephone yeah. systems.
Well, plain old POTS are insecure up to the point where they get to the switching station, at which right. point then they're mixed with a bunch of others and they're compressed and encrypted. So anyone could jump on a telephone line and listen to your over-the-air conversations
with
the plain old telephone line. They could mm-hmm. tap into it. Right. But if you have a home router provided by your internet service provider, it's encrypted at
from
your house,
point, yeah.
from your house. So it's actually more secure.
All right, Victoria, we'll be back and talk a little bit more about this after the break. Lots of room for you here this afternoon on the Internet Advisor Live. You can call us with your questions about your computer, about the internet connection, whatever you'd like to do. And we have the time and we have the experts in here to answer your questions. Again, at 800-859-0957. And Irv out there in Toledo will be with you in just a moment to help you with your Windows 7 question. Speaking about Windows, we had a happy customer. Tom got back in touch with us, guys. I thought it'd be kind of interesting to talk about this because when he first got in touch with us, he was just so fed up with Windows 8. He was saying, that's it. As a matter of fact, he capitalized the word hate. They hate Windows 8, and I must agree with them. I'm no longer able to help them with issues. And, you know, he was talking about the other people in his house.
Right.
So we gave him some ideas and some, matter of fact, Eddie in particular, he told him about the great resources there are online with videos to help you understand.
Correct. Microsoft provides some great tutorials, and I actually
YouTube.
Use YouTube. And, you know, that first week use of Windows 8, what am I supposed to do?
So he sent it back this week. He had an email back to us, said, thank you for addressing my questions on the show, encouraged by your other caller, the 76-year-old farmer on the combine who loved Windows 8.
That's yeah.
Ben, that's you.
That was Ben.
Yep. Ben Carpenter. I invested a significant amount of time this past week to figure out how to set up and use Windows 8. I decided at some point in the future my computer at work will also be equipped with Windows 8, and I better be able to function with it. My situation has improved, and I believe I can now help my wife and mom with their computer issues. He said, I'm still frustrated at times with quirks, and I agree with him, by the way. There are some times it makes me just crazy, but I'm learning and progressing, and personally, I believe that every new software should be more user-friendly, intuitive, and evolutionary improvement built on a previous version. And I think that was a big thing about Windows 8. It was such a change that people had a hard time getting their heads around it.
When you think about it, there was even more of a change when we all went to tablets, right, to the iPad.
Yep.
However, we expected that to be different, so we said, oh, it's going to be different, I'm going to learn
because
it.
The form factor was different.
Right?
Good
so
point.
When you look at Windows 8, because it looks like a computer, we don't expect it to be different, so we don't have the same attitude when we go about learning.
Right. And I have to say that Microsoft is also kind of going back, stepping back and helping people with, like, for instance, this Windows version 8.1 of Windows is an excellent one, an excellent way to, it really brings a lot of things back, a start menu and so many, many, many other things. Okay, let's go to Irv, who's waiting for us from Toledo. Hey, Irv, how you doing? Welcome to the Internet Advisor.
Well, I'm doing the best I can. I'm visually impaired, gentlemen,
okay.
And I've just bought a new system, a Hewlett-Packard Pavilion desktop
mm-hmm.
with Windows 7 on it.
Okay.
And, oh boy, am I having fun getting used to Windows 7. My old system was an XP.
It's interesting hearing you say that.
Whoa.
From all the people we have complaining about Windows 8. But so it's a big change for you, right?
Now, what a difference. I've got 8. I've got a disk with full version of 8, and I'm afraid to put it in. But what I've got going on is an icon down in my tool tray that says Network Tool or Network 2.
Okay.
And underneath of that, it says Internet Access. Now, do I want to open that or no?
Well, that's more than likely. It's a notification that your Network 2 adapter has Internet Access. Otherwise, it would say no access or no internet. So what happened? Laptops and desktops usually come with multiple network adapters.
That's right.
Laptops, and we're familiar with this because we have laptops. So we'll have a network one, and we'll also have a wireless network adapter.
Mm-hmm.
And the wireless network adapter will say internet access next to it. And if we hovered our mouse over the one that might be the standard network adapter, it would say no access, I believe is what it says.
Right. Right. Well, I am on a ISP hard cable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that from their modem that I can turn on the wireless.
Right,
modem.
But this message is on your laptop. So more than likely what's...
On
your desktop. I'm sorry. On your computer. So as Gary was speculating, Gary, why don't you tell him what you think that was?
So I believe that when you first connected, it said network.
Right.
And then for whatever reason that became corrupted, you decided not to use it, so you established a second network, and this is just to distinguish between the first one and the second one. If you still had the first one there, you could go back and forth between network and network two.
And when Gary
and
says
you yeah,
he means Windows,
right,
or you,
right.
Or some action you performed.
Yeah, you could have done it in purpose, and it could have happened to you because of something that happened within the system.
Now, I've seen this as someone that works on computers. Sometimes, for whatever reason, a network, the networking stops working. A good way that I've found to reload all of Windows network drivers is to go into the Windows Device Manager, and you could do this in Windows XP, Windows Vista, and Windows 7. And then you tell Windows to remove these network devices, and you do them one at a time. When the computer reboots, it rediscovers all the networks,
mm-hmm,
adapters, wireless and wired. Let me finish.
Okay.
And then it reloads the drivers for those and reloads networking, TCP/IP, and all your other protocols. So, but when it discovers your network adapter, it may identify it as network 2.
Yeah,
that's where I'm going.
That leads directly into the second part of my question.
Oh, good.
Is it possible I could have a business? I mean, I bought this this system.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible it could have been a business system? And it says it's home premium, Windows 7.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible someone was using it for a business?
Oh, it's certainly possible.
Yeah, sure.
You know, small business.
I mean, I had some people here from the Great Sight Center of Toledo, Ohio,
mm-hmm,
that helped me because I'm visually impaired.
Sure.
And when they went into it, they found that the previous owner... was a young lady, name of such and such,
mm-hmm,
and but that's all they could find. Other than it is Windows Home Premium, Windows 7.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so for some reason you have inherited a system that still had a lot of user information. It wasn't completely erased. So what I had speculated on is that at some point in the past, someone deleted or removed your network adapter so that Windows could reload, mm-hmm, all the software for that network adapter, and when it boot came back up, it came up as Network 2.
It identified itself as Network 2.
So on your taskbar, that's why it's showing up as Network 2. You really only have one network adapter. So what it really means is Network Adapter 2. But in essence, it's really Network Adapter 1, and it has internet access.
Well, then that is not just a standard part of Windows 7.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It does not come with all versions of Windows 7. It is something that I can remove.
No, do not remove that. That is just a notification bar that's telling you have internet access.
Well, if you remove it, and now you want to reestablish a network connection, it'll come up Network 3.
Yes.
And, great.
Yeah, but
right?
But
I have, I think, Network 3 or Network 4 on mine right now.
Irv, a rose by any other name would smell the same. Have you ever heard that?
But all that does is distinguish it from the first time you've established an internet connection. As long as you don't...
It just means basically you can
keep using 2,
right.
But if you ever take 2 down, the next one will be 3.
He'll have a difficult time, though, re-enabling that. He may have a difficult time.
Windows 7 has already got more bells and whistles on it than I'll ever need.
Mm-hmm.
And Network 3, that's all I need.
So all that means is that it's the third time you've gone ahead and established that whole network.
In other words, don't be blown away by this whole thing. We've taken a little time to explain this for you because of other people who may find themselves in the same situation, which is why we take the time to do this kind of thing, because it applies to other people as well.
And if you were to, if you did not have a network on your device,
right,
you could take and take out the word two, or to the number of two. And it'll just be network. So that's your label. That's the name of the network.
Yep. I see.
Yeah, and realize that that.
And but if you did have another network connection, and now you want to take network two and take out the two, now you've got a conflict. So that's bad.
So just out of curiosity, how?
Be afraid of.
No, don't be afraid of it at all. Go ahead and use it.
We don't have time to answer.
All right. Hey, Herb, thank you so much, Herb. We've taken more time than usual on this, but that's because we thought that there's a lot of answers that we got in there. So thank you very much. Hey, phone lines are open for you at 800-859-0957. If you got a problem and you don't call us to get some answers, shame on you. Remember, the only dumb question is the one you don't ask. 800-859-0957.
To the Internet Advisor. Once again, your hosts, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Rudell.
As some of you have learned, and I hope more of you before our show ends here, Annie Nichols is in today. Annie, good to have you there answering the phones.
You can hear her smile.
That's right.
When you call.
Rich Luzinski also in-house. By the way, next week, folks, we're going to be having the folks from Pinkerton in. We're going to be talking about them having their new office in Ann Arbor, and they've gone from being just private eyes and security firm to being security now of digital goods as well. Mm-hmm. Kind of fascinating. They've moved to Ann Arbor. They think it's the place to be for them. That's Pinkerton. People who really gave private eye, that whole notion because of their symbol, private mm-hmm. eye, applied across the board to all those who were doing protection kind of work. Okay, the phone number again, 800-859-0957. Let's go to Timothy in Southfield. Timothy, welcome to the Internet Advisor. How can we help you?
Thank you. Yeah, I've just had this problem crop up on my computer, I guess this last week. I have a Windows 7 computer that I built myself. It's an AMD processor. Mm-hmm. And it's about 2 years old. And I've got a wireless Microsoft keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the control key, like if I'm going to do control C for copy or control V for paste and stuff like that, mm-hmm. doesn't activate. And sometimes a backspace will it'll backspace once, but I can't make it backspace a whole bunch of times in a row by holding it down.
Hmm.
And sometimes even the shift key, if I'm trying to type a number of capital letters in a row, the shift key won't work every time.
Are you left-handed or right-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Okay, because there's another shift on the other side of the keyboard and another control key, and I've run into this too when I'm running across failing keyboards. Is have you tried to see if the other control key works?
That it way doesn't work any better. Okay. I already tried that.
Okay, perfect. So that means what we're probably dealing with is an electronic issue, failing of the device rather than a mechanical.
Uh-huh. Now, the keyboard is older than the computer.
Yeah.
Okay. And you said it's wireless?
Yes.
Okay. I would, the number of things I would guess, but I mean, I think I would immediately, I'd say it's the wireless keyboard.
Well, you know, first thing I would think of is batteries, of course.
Okay.
And then.
Not that, I just replaced that was the first thing I did.
Okay. Yeah. And have you got like a USB?
That's good.
Is it the USB nub that you plug into the back of your computer, or is it the Microsoft tether with like a docking station?
Well, it is, there's the receiver which sits on my desk, and then it's got a split cable. It's got a USB port, and then it's got that purple round
thing to plug into
because it's supposed to be made for a mouse and a keyboard. I'm not using the mouse, but I unplugged that to see if that would make a difference, and now it's running on just the USB port, and it's no different.
Yeah. The only thing I could think of is, trying in another computer. You know, just unplug it and plug it into a laptop and see if it works. And I've already suggested the other, checking the mechanics of the keyboard by using the other shift and control keys. And you've already tried that, too. It sounds like your keyboard's going.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, really.
They're fairly cheaply made, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the good thing is they're cheap to buy a new one.
They are, yeah.
And it'll be better. I mean, right
it
now.
It will be better.
Yeah. Right now, you're using a Microsoft proprietary, you know, it uses 2.4 gigahertz, but it's a proprietary RF signal, and that's unique to it and that Microsoft used. It's not using Bluetooth. It's not using Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah, it's although not it uses an industry the same standard.
Yeah, although it's using the spectrum that's available for home use, it's using a spectrum that steps on everyone else's Wi-Fi. So this is an opportunity for you to get rid of that device and maybe use it and purchase something that's true Bluetooth that won't step over the frequencies of the wireless technology that's been developed now.
That was kind of an older first generation.
It's like the cordless phones that we all had in their house.
So I don't have to buy a new keyboard. I get to.
I love the way you put that.
Oh, yes.
Is that how you're going to explain the expense to your wife?
Yeah, I was just going to say, would you like a note to your wife? We can write that note for you.
Are there any brands in particular that you recommend that are not the top end? I don't like to spend more than I have to, obviously, if I rebuild my own.
Oh, boy.
I'm guessing we're all going to say the same one. But
I was going to say, you're going to Logitech.
Logitech.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you take your, 30 or 90 day in-store warranty. You know, how often do you want to go back when the thing starts failing inside of 30 or 90 days? Logitech has a great reputation. They're mid or top range.
But most of them today are going to be pretty good.
I mean, if I go to Micro Center, I've taken the chance on some wireless keyboards, and I've done okay. They seem to work okay.
Yep.
You know, but it's hit or miss.
But well, what you said before, Ed, in this particular case, is that you're also getting the benefit of that newer Bluetooth technology.
That's right. For any of the keyboards you buy today are going to be better than what he has.
Okay,
well,
Tim.
Logitech's always been my default, so thank you. I will go get one.
Okay. All right, sir. Thank you. Hey, just quickly, a quick question for you, Tim. What do you use for your passwords? Do you? We're going to take a little survey here.
Do you?
How do you keep your passwords?
I use really, really difficult passwords, except on the I don't care about them websites.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good. Very good.
I've created them myself, except I keep them stored on a doc file on my computer, and I have a difficult password to get into my computer. But then I also I just started this new thing, Dashlane. I'm trying that out.
Dashlane? I don't think I've heard of it.
Yeah. I've heard good things about it.
Okay.
So far, it seems to be doing okay for me. It'll create my own passwords for me, and it offers to log me in, and it does log me into some things. So it may work good, but I just sort of, like I said, I keep a big doc file with probably 60 or 70 really complex passwords on it.
Now, do you take and encrypt that doc file? Because you can do that as well, just like Excel.
I'm not that bright.
So actually, it's just a pull-down menu, and it says encrypt.
I just scotch tape a piece of paper on the wall where anybody can read it. No, I don't do that.
But they had to break into your house, and you have good deadbolts.
That I got. But no, I keep it in my computer, which I don't leave on when I'm not in the house. But,
gotcha.
But no, I don't encrypt. I haven't thought about that, but that's an interesting idea.
So it's actually fairly easy to do. So, and I know a lot of people that do that with Excel spreadsheets, and they'll encrypt them and then have a very complicated password to get into the Excel spreadsheet.
You know, and that's one of the things that work, people will come up to me and say, I have this Excel spreadsheet from 2003, and I don't remember the password to get into it. Oh. And I'm like,
good luck.
Good luck.
There's no way in.
Crackers out there that'll bust
there's
that.
No way.
Nope, you're...
Right.
So, Tim. Whatever you do, if you do that, remember that password.
All right, Tim, thanks a million for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I love listening to you guys.
All right, appreciate it so much. Okay, folks, hey, if you got a question out there, don't forget, we got about 20 minutes left, a little less than that. 800-859-0957. Come on in. Put down the lemonade and give us a call. Paul from Pontiac, how may we help you on the Internet Advisor?
Well, I recently got a new laptop.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Touch screen running 8.1.
Good.
And I got fingerprints all over the screen. How do you get those off?
You know what's worse is my touch screen, I love it, but my office computer has fingerprints on it too because I wanted to touch that screen.
I know, I do the same thing. Yeah, exactly.
I get frustrated. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's a pain, but was wondering, should I be concerned about making a system restore disk?
Very good question.
This is a great one for Ed.
Yep. Oh, yeah, definitely. That's the first thing I do. When I first power on a computer, you know what I do? Well, first thing I do is, yes, create the restoration disk. And I have to find out, I'm not sure about this, but I believe with Windows 8.1, it allows you to create a restoration USB drive. So it'll let you create not only a system recovery, Microsoft system recovery disk or on a flash drive, but they're making flash drives so large now that you can actually put them on a USB drive.
Well, in my Surface Pro,
yeah, you don't have
it. That's the only thing I can do is put a USB drive in it.
That's interesting. Yeah,
when I was looking for laptops, it was actually a little difficult to find one with a disk drive.
Yeah, you got to buy externals today and just connect it via USB.
So. Yeah, I wonder how much longer that's going to be around. So,
so how do you go about doing that?
Well, who's the manufacturer of your laptop?
It's an Asus.
Usually there's a... I don't know specifically about Asus, but if it was an HP or a Dell, and I'm assuming it's the same thing with Asus. Someone told me it's pronounced like Pegasus, so it's Asus. You should have a program group there called for system recovery somewhere. Now, is yours running Windows 8?
Yeah,
yes, Windows 8.1. By the way, I'm on Windows 8.1 right now. And what I did, by the way, and this is for anybody else out there, if you want to find something about your system, simply go either with your finger into the right-hand corner or take your mouse, if you're running a mouse. I just happen to have one with me right now that's on a mouse. Go to the right-hand corner and bring up the search, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I tell you what, we're going to put you on hold. And I want to tell you about this because it's a great way of finding things on your Windows 8 machine.
Right. So. And there's two things, basically. You got the manufacturer's system restoration, but Windows 8 also provides an integrated restoration, and that's what we're going to talk
about. That's exactly it. We're
going to
come back and talk about that. And we got some time for your call as well at 800-859-0957.
Kids have the craziest ideas about food. Where do they get this stuff? Like eating Brussels sprouts helps you hit home runs. And eating carrots gives you X-ray vision? It's nuts. And I honestly have no idea where my daughter got this notion that broccoli is the official food of professional ballerinas. Kids, the only reason my 4-year-old loves cantaloupe is because he's convinced it comes from the moon.
Run. Small step for man. Lots of potassium for mankind.
And the other day when my oldest came up to me and said, Mom, will eating peas and carrots really help me pull off a fakie frontside ollie with a twist? I look him in the eye and say, it can't hurt, honey. It can't hurt.
Moms everywhere are finding creative ways to help their kids eat 5 servings of fruit and vegetables a day. Get ideas, get involved, get going at letsmove.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
Is the Internet Advisor. We're taking your calls at 800-859-0957. That's 800-859-0957. Now, Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and Ed Riddell.
It's been a pleasure being with you today. And by the way, if you've enjoyed our show today and you'd like to hear the podcast of the program, if you missed some part of it, or would like to listen again to what Richard Steenen had to say about the Black Hat conference he was at and some of the things that he's looking at as concerns in the world of security on the Internet. Fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I'm so glad he blew the wind out of the sails of that $1.2
billion. Oh, yeah.
And that just seems such an outrageous number.
Yep. And the article he gave as well was a great one for putting it apart very carefully and giving an explanation for why they said that's just a lot of nonsense. But anyway, if you'd like to hear our podcast, you simply wait till Sunday night, and I'll post that up there for you on our homepage at internetadvisor.net. You can also subscribe to it on iTunes. Okay, 800-859-0957. We do have time for another couple of calls, but we want to go back to Paul. Paul, thank you very much for calling us. And you asked about, you've got a new computer with Windows 8.1 on it, and you want to know how to create a restoration disk. And both Gary and I are on the Surface Pro 2. So we have that machine in front of us, and I'm going to describe some of the things there. But did you have a further question you were going to ask, Paul?
There's one general annoyance on my mind.
Okay, well, let's get back to that then. What I wanted to say was that one of the first things you can do, and this is for just about anything you have a question about on your computer with Windows, it's really a nice function. And that is you simply go to that right corner, if you've got a mouse, and you pop up the place where you've got the little
charm search,
you know, and it says search at the top of the little magnifying glass. You can go there, and or you can go to the desktop and just start typing anywhere you want on the home page. And the point is that will bring up a search right away. And in that search, then, you can ask, for instance, create a recovery disk or anything you want. And it'll start with things that are on your computer and lead you to those, and then also take you onto the internet, for instance, to find answers as they're well there.
Well, one thing I noticed, though, with Windows 8, and I did not bring my Windows 8 system to the studio today. I brought my Windows 7 laptop, and I was searching for this identical thing. When I typed in system recovery disk or recovery, the search did not find it in Windows 8.
No.
You're kidding. Didn't find it.
No. You have to actually be very specific with Windows 8. It went to Bing, and I'm like, I know there's an application on here. So as Foster was going to say, you have to actually use the correct terms. Recovery drive?
Create recovery drive.
Or just recovery drive and system image.
Oh, what it comes up with, for instance, there's a couple of very – one of the things is the simplest thing to do is that you go and you press the Windows key. You know which one that is, right, Paul?
Sure.
And then W. And that comes up then with a place where you can simply type in create recovery drive. And then you click on the result, and then you follow the on-screen instructions to create a backup of your recovery partition on a thumb drive. Which the recovery partition is, there's a place on the drive on every one of these Windows 8.1 machines that has, it stores a little space there that you can't get at. You can't store anything in it. You can't access it normally. But that's where it has all the building blocks necessary to rebuild your computer should something happen. Okay? And that's what you create your recovery disk from. And so all the information about doing that is right there. And then you can...
It's a bootable flash drive usually, right? So you can make a CD or a bootable flash drive. I believe 2 gigs is about... if you had a 2 gigabyte flash drive, that's more than adequate. And for making the recovery drive.
Now, do you have an optical drive on your? Pardon, excuse me, just a second, Paul. On your computer, do you have an optical drive? You know, for playing DVDs.
I do.
You do. Okay. Well, then you could burn it onto there, or what's even simpler is just to put it onto a USB.
Right.
And it will be just fine. I mean, you've got it and you got it set. And that's your recovery drive.
And this is what I did with mine. I created a USB flash drive, a 2 gigabyte. You can buy them for $2 or $3 at Micro Center.
I
have a bunch of them lying around the house. And the other thing is then I created my system image, and then I taped the flash drive to the package where I put the system image, which was on an external drive.
Tell DVDs. What's the difference between the system image and the recovery
drive? System image is a clone of your Windows 8. So
yes.
that's like your restoration CDs that you were talking about.
But it has everything that you have on the PC right now.
Right then and there, yes.
Right.
So you can either burn it to an external, you can burn it to your CD, or you can burn it to an external drive. You know, not burn it. I'm sorry. You can copy it to an external hard drive, USB
flash
drive. So, Paul,
if I'm right, Eddie, correct me on this then. The recovery drive will simply put back the bare bones, the basics of Windows 8.1 onto your computer.
Recovery drive, I believe, is a small Windows graphical environment that lets you run diagnostics and repair, lets you reinstall Windows, lets you refresh it to factory settings. If your hard drive hasn't failed completely, as Foster said, there's a hidden partition on there.
Yeah.
And then you can restore. And Windows allows you the ability to
restore.
And Paul's
got a fairly new machine, right, Paul? This is a new machine for you, right?
Yes.
Okay. So then the system image that you're talking about, Ed, that is the actual picture of the entire contents of his drive as it is right now.
Yeah, and that's the one
pictures and programs and documents.
And that's the one you put in Grandma's house. as Gary does. Yeah.
Yep.
So you know that the difference between the two then? Do you see, Paul?
Yep.
Yeah, you actually need both of those. You need the USB flash drive, 2 gigabyte, to create the restoration, right? A recovery, the bootable recovery drive. And then you need your system image as well. So if you search for those two terms, or you can go into Microsoft's website or use Bing and type in Windows 8 system recovery and a system image.
And by the way, the first when I typed in that create recovery disk, the first place that the search took me to was the Microsoft community. Okay, Paul? So for anybody else out there, this is why I want to take a little bit of time explaining what search does in Windows 8. It's different from what it did before.
Yeah, and it can be confusing a little bit.
Right. It's so comprehensive, I think.
Well, Microsoft could have done a much better job on the restoration of these restoration disks on here. They changed the terminology on us once again. They didn't make it easy to find it in the search.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you can go watch videos on it.
Now, Paul, I'm just curious. You had another question?
So I'm thinking this is why people don't like to get new computers.
Yeah, and particularly one with Windows 8.1. You're right.
It's just we're upgrading, the operating system.
Technology is changing so quickly. Oh, as you observed yourself.
Yeah, and you've got to, make all this stuff that you can't just open up out of the box and start using.
You could certainly do that, but... once you put your data on there, create your system image then.
I'm going to go back to something this email that we got from Tom, who had the problems. He was so fed up with the process, he was going to give it up and go back to Windows 7. And we just encouraged him to keep on trying, like you are. And he said, I've updated to Windows 8.1, and he said that he's seeing it as beneficial, especially for his mom, because it's so simple. And he thanked us for helping him to kind of hang in there and keep on trying.
It's actually a lot more simple for people that don't know Windows 7.
Yes.
Right? If you aren't encumbered by what you want it to be or think it should be, and just to learn it, it's actually not too bad to learn.
Paul, what was your background with computers before this?
I went from an XP system.
Okay. And what did you use it for? Did you use it just at home for email and things like that?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Little bit of Excel.
Yeah. And I think that's, for somebody coming from XP to Windows 8.1, that's a big jump. But the good news, again, is there is a ton of video out there on YouTube. And if you go to Microsoft, they have a lot of great instructionals there as well. So, Paul, thanks so much for sticking with us here, because I hope that we've been able to help a lot of other people as well. Ed and Gary, thank you so much for being with us.
Folks, you
have a great weekend. Don't forget that if you still have questions, you can get them through to us. And you folks who are listening to us on our affiliates, we love to take questions from you as well. Just simply go to internetadvisor.net, to the Contact Us button on there, and then put in your email address and your question, and we'll get back to you just as quick as we can. Thanks again for another great week here on the Internet Advisor. We come back next week. We'll be talking about the people who brought us Private Eyes, Pinkerton, moving to Ann Arbor.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show, Detroit's longest-running, locally produced computer show with Foster Brown, Gary Baker, and their team of experts. For more information about our weekly show, to ask a question of our experts, or to find the show notes for this podcast, visit www.internetadvisor.net and look for us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.